Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, April 25th. Military families are looking forward to finally getting their day in court after suffering from fuel-contaminated drinking water. We set the stage for next week's trial. And Hawaii's Judiciary Center, the Ali'iolani Building, Hale Building, is marking its 150th anniversary. We pause to reflect on its history. We hear from a college student from Lahaina who shares how a generous scholarship offered by Maui's construction industry will ultimately help her return to rebuild her hometown. Plus, a Molokai teacher will get a trip of a lifetime exploring the undersea world, and English language kabuki theater here in the islands turns 100. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been almost 2 years, 2.5 years, since fuel-contaminated water turned the lives of thousands of families upside down. More than 90,000 people relocated to hotels after fuel from underground tanks at Red Hill got into their tap water. Come Monday, a number of active duty members and their spouses will tell their stories to a federal judge who is to set damages for their pain and suffering. We talked to attorney Christina Baer, who is representing the families in this most unusual lawsuit.
First of all, I'm just thankful to be able to be in court telling our client's story, because that's ultimately what they want. They want accountability. They want the judge to hear them. They want to be able to tell the public about what happened to them. And the government for so long has been minimizing the harm. And this is an opportunity to show what the harm really was. You know, they've always admitted the negligence. What they haven't admitted is the extent of the harm. So I know you had on Hawaii Public Radio Dr. O. Well, Dr. John O described the need for a registry to track people's health over time. And it's going to be an independent registry. They're spending millions of dollars on that registry. In fact, $1 million at least every year in perpetuity. And yet, in the case itself, the government is arguing that there wasn't enough fuel in the water to have a toxicological effect. Well, how is that possible? If there wasn't enough fuel in the water to make anyone sick, why do we have a registry for millions of dollars in perpetuity? That's the real problem here. When it comes to the families, the government minimizes the harm and pretends it didn't happen altogether. And yet, outwardly, there are good people in the government who are saying that's not true, that it did happen, that people did get sick, and people are still sick, and they still have neurological harm.
And you were trying to get more information pertinent to the spills and that negligence in front of the judge, just to talk about, you know, maybe how this could be prevented. And that apparently is not going to happen. You had a whistleblower and apparently took a deposition from the fuels director, Shannon Banks, and I understand that that's not going to be reviewed by the judge?
That's right. But it's not going to be reviewed by the judge because she found that it had already been proven. She said the government is presumed to have knowledge because the government has admitted liability. So it's presumed to have knowledge of the risk and to have, in fact, been liable for premises liability, for nuisance, for negligence. So we're coming into this trial with the plaintiffs as the prevailing parties. And now we get to present the extent of the harm. And that's really what's a dispute in this case anyway, is the extent of the harm.
Well, this is an unusual case where you actually have members of the military suing the military.
It's true. And what a wonderful country we live in, where the United States has waived its immunity to allow claims like this. The government wants to be liable, you know, not this particular government, but writ large. The United States says, we are going to waive immunity to allow the people who have been harmed by the negligence of the United States to bring a claim for the harm. That's a beautiful thing. That's the purpose of the Federal Tort Claims Act. So this case is what the Federal Tort Claims Act was made for.
Anything else that you can share about what you plan to present in the trial?
We plan to present that people got sick because the Navy didn't tell them that there was fuel in the water. This is a case about a government that contaminated the water and then didn't tell people that it was contaminated and allowed people to get very, very sick. And then the government looked at the sick families and said, you're not sick. And that's the posture that the government is choosing to come into court with. The government is choosing to come into court and claim that there was never enough fuel in the water to make anyone sick at all, and that any symptom is stress-induced. We're going to show that that's not true, that people still have neurological harm, and that the mental harm is extraordinary, in part because the government continues to deny what happened, at least in court.
Well, I believe I talked to a couple of the families that you represent, and some of them did not go through the clinic that the military set up, that they went out to private hospitals and got care, but, you know, out of pocket.
That's right. The government refused to give people even the most basic lab. And so while we don't have a medical negligence claim, our clients are going to come in and talk about that. What did it feel like for the Feint family to go to Tripler Medical Center? And Mandy Feint is a major in the Army, got the appropriate level of care. She got all the tests. She got EKGs and labs and the whole nine yards. And her family, who went in with the same symptoms, vomiting, diarrhea, burns, they were given an otter pop and told to go away. They begged for labs and they were denied. So that's all part of the experience that the clients are gonna talk about. And the judge is gonna hear it all. They're gonna look at the judge and tell her everything that has happened to their families. The Feint family and the Freeman family, both of them have had over 400 medical appointments since their exposure. These are families who were once healthy and happy and fine. And their experience is consistent with Dr. John O, who's a government's doctor, who is the head of the Defense Health Agency, and he acknowledges that, in general, people are sicker now. And that's true for many of the plaintiffs, not all of them, but many of them. And for those who aren't sick, they've been through a traumatic event, and they've lost faith in their government that they served. And this was incredibly traumatic for them. It was life-changing for every single one of the plaintiffs that are going to testify in court. Of course, it was different for each one of them. Not everyone has the same level of harm. But I think the judge is going to hear and appreciate the extent of the harm that they're going to testify to. And that's what this case will really be about, the extent of the harm and the plaintiff's experiences of the last 2.5 years.
And do you have a sense today of how many people might get called?
We have 24 witnesses, and those are plaintiffs and experts. And then the government has their own experts.
That was attorney Christina Baer. She questions how much the worry about future illness is worth. Her firm, Justwell Law, represents a number of families who are seeking damages from the military after the Navy's underground fuel tanks contaminated their drinking water 2.5 years ago. Trial is set to begin in federal court Monday. And in a new development this morning, the Navy announced that laboratory contamination is to blame for the levels of TPH, or total petroleum hydrocarbons, that were found in samples taken this year throughout the Navy's water system. The Navy Closure Task Force says that the skewed results were not associated with the release of jet fuel from the Red Hill underground facility. It does plan to keep testing to determine what is causing the reports of odors, sheens, and other health concerns.
Psychologist Peter Gray has a message for parents and teachers. Let the kids play.
In many ways, adults have taken over children's lives. And I think the cost of that has been that it takes away from children's own opportunities to figure things out for themselves.
How to help children thrive, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
judicial history will come alive on Oahu this weekend. The current home of our Hawaii Supreme Court, the Ali'iolani Hale Building, turns 150 years old on Tuesday. Back in the day, it first served as a seat of government of the Kingdom of Hawaii. The anniversary will be marked with a special open house and free dramatic reenactments on the grounds on Saturday. We talked to Matt Matisse and Kiahi Davis of the Judiciary Center earlier this week. On a downtown architecture walking tour I was fortunate to take years ago, I learned that it was a monument to good design. It was the first building in Hawaii native using a new innovation at the time, concrete from Australia. What I didn't know was it houses a rich treasure of judicial stories and artifacts. Matt Matisse, the executive director of the Free Public Museum Space, starts us off.
The building was conceived of by Kamehameha V, who wanted both a capital building for the kingdom, a government building, and also a palace. The appropriations from the legislature weren't as robust as he had hoped, and he didn't get funding for both buildings, and he opted for the government building. The building opened in 1874 and housed the kingdom's legislative hall, kingdom supreme court, attorney general, governor of Oahu, Department of Education, Department of Health. It was the first time in Hawaii's history that all the government offices were located in one central building.
And then we are here in this particular office just next door to your desk, and I understand that you have a personal connection to this building.
In 1872, when the groundbreaking ceremony was held, my great-great-great-grandfather, Alexander Joy Cartwright Jr., was the first speaker on the program, and that's my personal connection.
And so as you sit here and shuffle through your papers on your desk, what are you struck by?
I'm struck by a sense of responsibility. I often take the lead, in my mind, protecting the building during film shoots and things like that.
You want to protect what's here?
Yeah, I definitely do. This is a very important site. I've got this personal connection, and it makes me realize that so many of us have personal connections to this space. Whether you've had a relative argue cases here, or have been impacted by decisions, seeking justice, we all have a connection to this building. It still remains a significant site and a very special place.
Now, I'm struck by the exhibit that we just walked through, and I feel very badly that I hadn't seen it before in all my years here, and I'm hoping that people will use this opportunity to come learn about this building and our history.
My name is Keahe Davis. I'm the education director here at the King Kamehameha V Judiciary History Center.
And yeah, so tell us more about the exhibit and what you've got going on this weekend.
We are celebrating the 150-year anniversary of the opening of the building, opening of the legislature. That was an event that was attended by King Kalaukaua, along with Prince Leleohoku, at the time was the designated heir. Princess Liliu was here, as well as Princess Ruth, Princess Pauahi, Queen Kapi'olani, Dowager Queen Emma. They were all in attendance at the opening of the building. So it was a very important event, a monumental event here. And so, of course, we're going to be celebrating that. We have an event on Saturday that's open to the public. We're usually not open on the weekends, but we'll be open to the public. They can come, folks can come in and take tours of the building. We have two separate times that are available, 1 o'clock and at 2:30, where we're going to have folks who will be presenting some folks in history, like Emma Nakuina, who was the curator of the National Museum, which was here during the Kingdom period. Yeah, so it's going to be a pretty exciting event for us. So the people can expect to hear and see the story of the building itself. When our building was constructed, when construction began, Iolani Palace was not across the street there. There was a much smaller home over there, which was originally called Hanai Loia. The name on that older house was changed to Iolani by Kamehameha V in honor of his younger brother, Kamehameha IV. And so Kamehameha V, being this king who wanted to really make sure that the kingdom was a center on the world stage, right, in terms of modernity and the like, had all these construction projects going on, places like the brand new post office made of concrete down Merchant Street, which today we call the Kumukahua Theater. Going up Nu'uanu Avenue, Mauna'ala, the Royal Mausoleum was being built. And at that time, some of the workers doing that construction were from Australia. And Kamehameha V liked the work they were doing. He also knew that down in Sydney, Australia, there was a group of architects. And he knew that the climate in Sydney, particularly during their summer months, is very similar to the climate here year-round. So what basically happened is there is a competition for the design of a new Iolani Palace in the Kingdom of Hawaii. And the person that won the competition was the vice president of the Sydney Architectural Society. His name was Thomas Rowe. He submitted two designs for a new palace. Both the designs make their way up here to Hawaii. At that time, they were already ready to start construction on the new Capitol building, but the plan they had wasn't really fully developed. And so what they decided to do is use the second plan, Plan B, that had been submitted for the new palace as the design for this building. So they started construction in 1872. The building is completed in April of 1874. And so the palace as we see it today is actually completed 8 years later in 1882. And it's actually a fourth revision of this design. Many folks don't realize that this is actually the site of the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. 1893, January 17th, Marines gather in front of our building, and then the 13 guys calling themselves the Committee of Public Safety gathered in our Mackay hallway to proclaim the provisional government overthrowing Queen Liliuokalani and the Kingdom of Hawaii. So the overthrow actually took place here. This was the seat of government, which some folks don't actually realize.
One more thing is the idea of a Judiciary History Center in a state or, you know, in a courthouse is pretty unique to Hawaii, and I know we have Chief Justice Richardson to thank for that, and his successors. I've worked here for too long to want to say how long, but I've worked under Chief Justice Moon and now Chief Justice Rechtenwald, and our judiciary has been very supportive of our mission, and we're very thankful that we have the judiciary and legislature support. But it's a hard task to take a hard look at our history and learn lessons from it. And we're very thankful that our leadership has allowed us to do that.
That was Matt Matisse and Kiahi Davis of the Judiciary Center. Hidden in the historic building is a time capsule of sorts. One of the concrete cornerstones houses a collection of artifacts, including newspapers, currency, and art of the era. That history is also celebrated with an art exhibit curated by the State Foundation of Culture and the Arts. So history fans, as well as lovers of architecture and design, will not be disappointed with this weekend's offerings. Look for links on the conversation page of our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we're taking you out into Honolulu Harbor. For decades, dinner cruises have been a popular entertainment option for visitors to Oahu looking to enjoy a meal with a view. Today, the Star of Honolulu is Hawaii's largest dinner cruise vessel. It can hold up to 1,500 passengers and was constructed in 1992. But years earlier, that title belonged to a different vessel. This catamaran was constructed in Keihi Lagoon in 1984 and could carry up to 1,000 passengers. At the time, it was said to be the world's largest passenger catamaran. The vessel stretched 170 feet long and weighed 200 tons, with memorable ki'i or tiki on each of its hulls. This dinner cruise was managed by Roberts Hawaii, but ceased operations in 2015. You can still see it today, boarded up and tied to Pier 5 in Honolulu Harbor along Ala Moana Boulevard near Restaurant Row. For today's backyard quiz, can you give us the name of this catamaran? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
So
support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Lahaina Zunali is finishing her first year at Gonzaga University. She's majoring in civil engineering, minoring in business, supported by a $30,000 scholarship. It's thanks to the Maui construction industry. Lee's goal is to ultimately return to rebuild her hometown. She's seen firsthand how last year's wildfires made Maui's housing crisis worse. Her parents spent months in a hotel after losing their home and just recently moved into a rental unit not far from the neighborhood she grew up in. Lee talked with The Conversation's Lillian Song about how she felt guilty about leaving her home in ruins.
The fire happened 2 weeks before I was supposed to leave for college, so it was extremely difficult. There was like a lot of guilt, and now a lot of people who also had to leave to go to college around that time felt like a guilt of leaving and just not being able to do anything, leaving your family behind, and they have to deal with it, but you'd know you'd be sort of set for the next 4 years of college and stuff like that. Losing everything, especially in that time of like transition, was extremely difficult. Definitely wasn't great, but sort of felt necessary. So growing up in Maui, I bounced around basically almost every school. So I did a lot of moving around, but what stayed consistent is my interest in the STEM area. I really enjoyed learning about science, and I was always particularly good at math. And so what I'm interested in now, you know, engineering. Very math heavy. Yeah, I really enjoy working with technology and crunching numbers and just all the sciencey and math related subjects. And I took obviously like some introductory robotics classes, which would be like that tech side. But more where I discovered engineering was through my early on days of playing with Legos. Like I really enjoyed figuring out, although there's like sort of a plan of what you're supposed to build. There was a bucket I had of just a bunch of miscellaneous pieces from different sets that didn't belong. And I just sort of tried to build my own thing. And I also played like Minecraft, where I get to build my own type of like houses and just sort of work with, you know, Legos and Minecraft and stuff like that, which kind of brought me to engineering. And although it's not the same, you know, there were games and just extra fun activities. But I think that was the thing that like distinguished like, oh, I think I'm interested in working with my hands and critically thinking about like ways to put things together and stuff like that, which ultimately brought me to engineering. Yeah.
As you're playing with the Legos and you're putting together structures and building things, mm-hmm. you're realizing, hey, this is something I really enjoy. And so now you're going to be building things in human size.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and last year you were one of two Maui High School seniors to win the Bob Paulson CIM Scholarship. CIM stands for Construction Industry of Maui, and the award was $30,500.
Yes.
And why is a scholarship like the CIM important?
Before I knew about the Construction Industry of Maui Scholarship, I was seeking a internship for my senior project. In the beginning, I was sort of interested in mechanical engineering, but as I went to college and found my own interest, I discovered civil engineering, and I had a mentor, Kevin Keller, who is part of CDG Maui. He is chair of the construction industry of Maui. I was able to mentor under him and kind of showed me the ropes of like what he did on a day-to-day basis, and I also shadowed under other employees under CDG Maui and was able to see, you know, what type of things I was interested in and what they have to do in a day-to-day basis. So yeah, once I figured out I wanted to do engineering, I realized that I wanted to, you know, to seek higher education. I searched the web for like opportunities and scholarship opportunities specifically, along with like mentoring programs. So like I get an internship for my senior project. And then eventually I found Construction Industry of Maui's Bob Paulson Scholarship. And not only did this scholarship give me the opportunity to seek this higher education that I've always wanted to achieve, it allowed not just for the financial aspect to be covered, but sort of puts you at a position to start networking early on, because the construction industry is made up of many leaders of the community and of the industry. And so being one of the scholarship winners kind of gave me that bot to be able to network along with the opportunity of getting financial aid for my degree. Looking back now, it's just like it needed to happen. And, you know, I need to go to college. And even more, it's motivation now to come back to my community, help rebuild, and be one of the leaders that will help create change and positive change. And especially with, like, you know, the whole housing crisis, which you see in the news, has been even worse than it was before.
So looking forward, because of the relationships that you were able to build up through the Bob Paulson Scholarship, the adults that were able to mentor you, at this point, as you are just completing your freshman year, what would you like to leave our listeners with about your journey as you are embarking on a career? You know, you want to go into civil engineering, but also broadening your scope to include a minor in business.
Yes. As much as I do love working with numbers, and civil engineering will require me to be crunching numbers and stuff like that, but ultimately I'd like to work sort of in the leadership roles and be in like an overseeing position, and just kind of interested in that aspect of the industry, not just the numbers and the engineering heavy part, but the industry as a whole. And so that's why my like overall goal even now is to create a business like with the locals, for the locals in mind. And initially in high school, I did not want to come back to Maui because, you know, I've just been here all my life and it's just like the same old, and I want to experience like new places and go around. But after doing a lot of sort of gaining new experiences, I think I do want to come back, and I want to help the community and give back to the community that sort of raised me and brought me to be who I am today. So I would say that for any seniors right now in high school, or just, you know, in high school getting ready to figure out what they want to do, if they're interested in engineering related or design, or I think even landscaping, anything of that sort, the Construction Industry of Maui's Bob Paulson Scholarship is an insane opportunity that you can, you know, apply for. And there's not many opportunities like this, especially like being in Maui. So I think if anyone's interested in that sort of trade and wants to come back to Hawaii, and specifically Maui, to, you know, help with contribute to this industry, then I recommend, 100% recommend doing so. Because not only will you sort of be able to achieve going to seek a higher education, but you'll be able to network and have a foot in the door of the industry and just have a great community surrounding you. It's great to see more people, minorities, and more women especially representing engineering, and hopefully we'll have more in the industry of Maui.
That's Gonzaga freshman Yuna Lee talking with HPR's Lillian Song. The Construction Industry of Maui awarded Lee a $30,000 scholarship in honor of Bob Paulson, one of its founders. The deadline for applying for the annual scholarship is coming up fast. It's May 1st, so you don't have much time. We will have links on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
In Dallas, Texas, overall violent crime has dropped by 30%.
This will be a third consecutive year of overall violent crime falling in the city of Dallas, which is incredible.
Dallas has done it with the mayor's support and by using techniques often condemned by critics of American policing. But that doesn't mean that all violent crime is down, so we'll explore what's really happening in Dallas. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Exploring Down Under, a Molokai educator has been chosen to take a scientific trip on the vessel Nautilus this summer. It's a month-long adventure on the high seas. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwet-Pactel got a chance to talk to this lucky teacher. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
Hey, so who is this teacher and where exactly are they going?
Yeah, so Gandharva Mahinaho Ross is a Hawaiian language immersion teacher here on Molokai. And he was selected as a science communication fellow aboard the exploration vessel Nautilus, as you mentioned. And he'll be going in July and August, leaving Honolulu for, they'll be exploring near Jarvis Island, which is about 1,000 miles southwest of Oahu in the Pacific Remote Island Marine National Monument. And this is led by the Ocean Exploration Trust. They have an initiative exploring deep sea biology and geology and bringing that experience home to the community. So they will be looking at the undersea mountains and the sea life that lives there. And this will be the first look at a lot of this area, which is really exciting. Ross is one of 13 communication fellows selected this year worldwide. And he's the only one from Molokai, or from Hawaii. And there have been others in the past, but a very exciting opportunity for him. He teaches his students place-based and culture-based science education. So they, throughout the year, have visited various locations around Molokai. And I caught up with them when they were at One'ali'i Park, learning about coastal vertebrates. They've learned about invertebrates and plant life throughout the year. Ross is also a Hokulea crew member and has a close relationship with the ocean.
All my life I grew up in and around the ocean, but not really in the deep ocean. So this is something new and something exciting and brand new to go to places and see new things. So I'm always interested in learning new things. And one thing I remember when we were on Hokulea, our captain was Bruce Blankenfield, and one of his themes was Ime Ike, to always seek knowledge and learn new things about areas you haven't been to. So this is an awesome opportunity to imi ike and to imi na'awao and to find out new things and be able to share those experiences with the youth, the people all around the world, but especially here on Molokai. It's not all the time we get these kinds of opportunities to have Molokai people go do something that, like, usually we hear about these kinds of things on the news, but it's not us, it's somebody. So it's cool to represent Molokai and have an opportunity to do these types of things.
Well, it's so lovely that, you know, he was on the Hokulea, and so that whole navigation thing it's awesome, because then he'll be able to see all the undersea stuff.
Absolutely. So it's similar but different, and he, you know, hopes to bring as well, while he's on the vessel, greater access to this knowledge and science, specifically for Hawaiian language speakers as well, increase that access to immersion students, you know, around the world who may be interested in joining the voyage. They will be live streaming while on board, and he'll be bringing this experience to his students on Molokai as well as, you know, on a broader scale once he returns. Megan Cook is Director of Education and Outreach at the Ocean Exploration Trust.
This voyage is one of about a dozen that will happen during the Nautilus season, but this particular one will visit the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument and a beautiful place just south of the equator called Jarvis Island that is rich with a lot of history and known to be one of the most biodiverse places in the ocean. And we'll be going into the deep sea to look at ancient volcanoes, underwater ridges, and this will be the first time human eyes have ever seen them. So we'll have the chance to document not only the ancient history, how this part of the Pacific was formed, but what kinds of incredible animals live there. And everyone will be able to watch it live on nautiluslive.org, interacting with Mahina Ho and the rest of the team, as well as social media and all kinds of ways that we can connect to classrooms and community and really share this place live with the world.
So explain for our listeners, you know, the Nautilus is a vessel that, you know, sits on the water, but they've got, what, robotics, right, that they can deploy?
Yeah, so they'll be using car-sized robots, which is really huge, to go down and explore that ocean floor more than 13,000 feet down. So it'll be an incredible opportunity. Those robots are attached to cables or tethers that will be live streaming this information not only to the vessel, but available, as she said, worldwide. So folks can see it as it's happening, make those discoveries, you know, maybe they'll be finding new species, who knows? And they mapped this area on an earlier voyage, so they're now going back to explore really what type of life is there and dig a little bit deeper. There'll be about 50 crew members on board. That includes, you know, the navigation crew, the scientists, the educators, the, you know, communications people like Mahina Ho Ross, and this whole team will be right there, you know, again, looking through the eyes of the robots. They have lights, they have cameras, you know, all of the testing equipment on those robots, and they'll be really exploring these depths that, you know, as they said, haven't been seen before. So it's a pretty exciting opportunity.
Well, I'm very jealous. I'm very jealous. I would love to go out and do that. But yeah, I'm
sure we'll be able to live vicariously through them.
Yes, and I'm sure he'll be so jazzed, and he will, you know, impart that enthusiasm to his students. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Patil talking to us from Molokai. Look for her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Waikoloa Beach Resort on the island of Hawaii, offering kama'aina hospitality with a range of options for dining, shopping, and activities. More about rediscovering the Kohala Coast at waikoloabeachresort.com.
On the next Fresh Air, are we approaching the end of Hollywood as we know it? We talk with Daniel Bessner about his cover story for Harper's that examines the threats facing the entertainment industry, including the merging of big studios and what it means for those most vulnerable, the television and film writers. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
The University of Hawaii will be commemorating 100 years of English language kabuki in our islands this weekend. Kabuki is a Japanese theater art form known for its ornately decorated costumes and sometimes bright and colorful makeup designs. To mark the occasion, students will be performing Benten Kozo, a popular kabuki production that centers on a band of five thieves based on real criminals from Japan's Edo period. Theater and dance professor Julie Ietsi is overseeing the production. She sat down with the Conversation's Russell Subiono in our studio.
For those who may not be familiar with kabuki, can you kind of share what it is?
Well, kabuki is a traditional Japanese theater form. It's been around for over 400 years. It's gone through many iterations and progressions in that 400 years. Kabuki is a really difficult thing to define because it was the commercial entertainment of the Edo period, okay, from the early 1600s until the late 1800s, and it continues to today, and in that time it's progressed a lot. So, but there's this accumulation of plays, which range from dance plays to daily life plays to history plays to really bombastic plays, and they're all under this umbrella term kabuki?
I always thought kabuki was that form of theater where you make these really big expressions with your face. Is that part of it?
That is part of it. Yeah, those are the aragoto plays, which are really these big bravado plays. And there are those. And that's really what it's probably best known for, because of the really bold red and white or black makeup, you know, on the face. You see it on t-shirts, on bumper stickers. You can see it everywhere.
And UH is celebrating 100 years of the first known English language kabuki ever performed in Hawaii, which happened at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. How much do we know about that performance?
Well, we do know that it was performed by a group of Japanese Nisei, second generation students, because it was in 1924. That was a time when the second generation were just reaching college age here in Hawaii. There wasn't a drama department. There were plays that were done at the university, but people of Asian descent weren't necessarily cast in those, mostly Haole or Western plays. So they got together and did a play called The Faithful, which is based on Chūshin Gura, or the 47 Samurai. It was written by John Masefield, who was a British playwright. So it wasn't an actual kabuki play, but it was based on a kabuki play. It was advised by community members who were themselves kabuki actors, because English kabuki goes back 100 years in Honolulu, or in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. But Japanese kabuki goes back at least 130 years, and that came in with the immigrants from Japan.
I imagine when kabuki was starting to be showcased on a world stage in what seems like the late 1800s, early 1900s, the novelty, the decorated uniforms, the makeup, I feel like that was probably something that brought crowds to performances. What else separated kabuki in Hawaii or in America from other productions at the time?
Kabuki is a very presentational form. Mm-hmm. So if you go back to the late 1800s, 19th century, that you know, we have realism that was just developing. And so there were a lot of, you know, Europe, realism was all over the place. And then they encounter, people were going to Japan and encountering kabuki. It very much influenced the progression of theater in Europe thereafter, in the same way that woodblock prints influenced, you know, the visual arts.
And I imagine over the 100 years, at least, of having kabuki in Hawaii, I imagine it has evolved in that time. What kind of evolution do you see in the art now?
Well, let me talk a little bit about the evolution in Hawaii, because there really are, I would say, two very distinct developments in English. Because pre-war, there was a group, the University Theater Guild, that was made up of people of Hawaiian, Chinese, Japanese, and Haole descent. And they formed a group and did one play for each of those ethnic groups in the year. And that was formed in 1931. And so for 10 years, there was a play each year. There was a Japanese play done every year. And most of those were kabuki plays. Many of those were what were called Shin Kabuki or New Kabuki. So there were plays that were being written and premiering in Japan, and then soon after were being done here in Hawaii. So New Kabuki plays. It was pretty amazing, very much ahead of its time. In the post-war era, mostly traditional plays have been done, and traditional being those that were written pre-influence of Western theater. So you don't have so many talking heads. They're not, you know, different kind of logic happening in the plays. So those traditional plays are primarily what's been performed in the post-war era.
Did the war have any kind of effect? Did it kind of stall the progression of kabuki in Hawaii, you know, after the bombing and the subsequent treatment of Japanese Americans?
Definitely, yeah. In December of 1940 was the last kabuki that was performed at the University of Hawaii. After the bombing, there was a Japanese dance, Nihonbuyo, was very, very prevalent. That was not done publicly throughout, you know, the war. I talked with Onoe Kikunobu sensei, who was very young at that time. She said they would maybe play things very quietly in the house. But so all that stopped during the war. And there was a lot of kabuki done in Japanese in the community as well throughout, you know, from the 1890s through the 1930s. So that all stopped. And then there was a revival, 1948-49. Kataoka Tsujitaro, who was an actor who had come in 1900, wanted to impart kabuki to the young Japanese in the community. So he formed a group, the Kabuki Aikokai, or the Kabuki Lovers Association, and did a few performances to bring younger people in and pass on what his knowledge about kabuki. But that was really the last time it was done in Japanese in the community. And then from the 50s at the university, in the Department of Drama, which then became the Department of Theater and Dance, has kind of been the housing of kabuki. It's not really, we produce the productions, but that can't happen without a lot of input still from the community and the students and bringing artists from Japan.
Since kabuki was introduced to a worldwide audience, I imagine that elements of the art form has found its way into pop culture. Do we see elements of kabuki in local theater or in national performing arts? Can we say that we see it as an influence on an opera writer like Puccini, or a Broadway production like Sweeney Todd, or like a band like Kiss? Were they influenced by kabuki?
The latter one, I think you can definitely see it visually in a band like Kiss. And I think they even talked about being influenced by that broad aragoto, that kumadori makeup. I know they were known for sticking their tongues out and painting them red. And that comes from some of these very demon characters in kabuki sticking their tongue out. So that's one influence, certainly, in music. I think locally, there's influence, I think, in the way that many plays are directed. We have a lot of students who come through the Asian theater program or through the Department of Theater and Dance who have been involved in kabuki or other Asian theater productions. And the training for those is quite intensive. And so I think they take what they learn in their bodies and in their minds and apply that to the creation of new work locally.
And I know that UH is also showcasing a kabuki production titled The Maiden Benten and the Bandits of the White Waves, or more commonly known as Benten Kozo.
Yes.
There was a performance last weekend. The second and final performance is this weekend. Can you talk about the performance?
I would love to talk about the performance. Yeah, three more shows, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, this coming weekend. It's a really popular play in Japan. It's actually the third time it's been done at the University of Hawaii, but this production is different from the past two. There are three focal scenes, and it's a very tight story, runs about 90 minutes. The language of it is written in a kind of meter called shichigocho, 7-5 syllabic meter. And the playwright Mokuami, Kawatake Mokuami, was known for using this. And it's a very melodic, it's a very musical language. And so to hear it in English, I think, is quite a treat. To hear it in Japanese, actors will talk about the importance of delivering this is to entertain the ears, you know. And so we hope that anyone coming will have their ears entertained. It also has some visual spectacle, which I don't want to give away, but there's some wonderful visual spectacle, audience interaction, and a lot of surprises because there's a great deal of disguise and intrigue.
Oh, it sounds so exciting. How can people get tickets to the performance?
They can get tickets by calling the Kennedy Theater box office at 956-7655. They can go online to the Kennedy Theater website, and there's a link from the website to get tickets as well. Awesome.
Julie Yetzi, thanks so much for coming into the station today.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much.
That was UH Theater and Dance Professor Julie Yetzi talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. In addition to the kabuki production, the East West Center is also hosting an exhibit entitled Kabuki in Hawaii, Connections Through Time and Space. We'll have links to both on the conversation page of our website after the show.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member, your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that. Forget all the other concerns and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And now it's time to drop anchor and tell you the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we asked you to name a dinner cruise catamaran that was once Hawaii's largest. It was in operation from 1984 to 2015. Initially, the boat conducted daily tours of Pearl Harbor as well as Waikiki dinner cruises. More recently, it maintained a dinner service offering a buffet, dancing, and a performance to passengers. The vessel survived negative publicity in 2012 when staff accidentally served a three-year-old an alcoholic beverage. But its touring business shuttered 3 years later due to maintenance issues. We were looking for the name of the catamaran, and that would be the Ali'i Kai, which means ruler of the sea. Eagle-eyed listeners can still spot it today where it remains moored in Honolulu Harbor. And our winner is Leimomi from Honolulu, who shares that she had family who worked on the Ali'i Kai. And that's our quiz. If you have an idea to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that's it for us today. Up tomorrow, a Hanaho show as we close out Pickleball Month. Give us some feedback. Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you heard? Find the conversation, our show archived on our website or wherever you tune in for podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.